This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
An outrage at Stanford University now spreading across America.
This is a miscarriage of justice. I really think that something should happen to the judge. I know they're moving for a recall.
January 2015, two graduate students at Stanford see this man, Brock Turner, then a swimmer at Stanford, raping a 23-year-old unconscious woman behind a dumpster outside a campus fraternity party.
If my daughter were the victim of this, I'd be livid.
The graduate students take action, chasing Turner and pinning him down for the police. But the story doesn't stop there. At Turner's sentencing, he faced up to 14 years in prison. But Judge Aaron Persky giving the convicted rapist 6 months behind bars. Yes, only 6 months for three felony counts of sexual assault. The judge's reasoning? The rape carried, quote, less moral culpability because Turner was drunk at the time of the attack.
This is Too Long Should Read, the show that focuses on interesting long reads from around the internet. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Today's show is not about the Stanford rape case, but it also kind of is, because it's about rape, rape culture, and giving rape survivors a voice, and then listening carefully and meaningfully to that voice. We're focusing on a piece by Ken Armstrong and T. Christian Miller, published on The Marshall Project, titled An Unbelievable Story of Rape, which tells of a young woman fresh out of the foster care system in the United States who was raped, who told people about it, and who wasn't believed by her community and the people closest to her. It tells of how devastating that was for her. My guests today, giving a Malaysian perspective, are Melissa Ahir from Women's Center for Change and Shoba Ayar, counselor and board member of the Women's Aid organization. Shoba speaks first.
They're not sure first whether they should report or not. And many are often said that, please go and do a medical checkup. But in this country, if you don't do a police report, you can't get checked. So that's the first thing that you have to do. And for a rape victim, you know, going to a police report is the last thing that she wants to do. And she wouldn't know what to say. So this is why it's very important that people in the police station are very sensitive to how to accommodate and what to ask. But most often, from my experience as a social worker in Women's Aid previously, many police officers don't want to take this kind of cases. They say very leche kind, it's long drawn. They don't get anything out of it, and sometimes she's a reluctant witness. And for those reasons, they will say things like, are you sure? Tell me who was there. And if you lie, you'll be thrown into jail. Those kind of things, that's really unwarranted. And sometimes, you know, they are sent from one person to another person to another person, like as if no one believes her. Is this fair to the victim?
There's actually been research in Malaysia. I'm citing from a book called The Rape Report, An Overview of Rape in Malaysia. So the range of when people delay reporting, you can say the average is around 2 weeks. It is not a pleasant experience. In fact, it's the opposite of that. And there's many, many roadblocks. We don't know the roadblocks that have happened at home. Maybe somebody or the victim has been judged even at home before stepping at the police station. Stepping at the police station is the other roadblock.
The subject and story of this article has actually been covered in great and exceptional detail by these folks.
WBEZ Chicago, it's This American Life from Ira Glass. And I want to tell you about two police investigations. One of them is done so inspiringly well, it's like the detectives in it are like detectives on a television show. Smart and resourceful and great judgment and just police at their very best. The other case, same crime, lots of the same facts, is the opposite. It goes terribly. And the investigation that goes wrong in a very unusual way. It's like a game of telephone where one misunderstanding begets another until something that is not true spreads to an entire community of people and somehow hardens into the truth.
Enormous footsteps to follow, and I would definitely urge you to pop on over and listen to This American Life's episode on this, episode 581, Anatomy of Doubt, because it's excellent. In the podcast, here's how the subject of the article, Marie, describes her ordeal.
Marie was home by herself, and she was awake all night, talking on the phone with her ex-boyfriend, Jordan.
I got off the phone and went to sleep. And then opened my eyes and there was somebody in my house. He had a knife in his hand and was wearing a mask. He blindfolded me and gagged me and tied my hands behind my back.
He raped her. He went through her stuff. He took pictures. He knew her name. Marie prayed he wouldn't kill her.
She then goes to the cops and tells her story, only for her own foster parents to tell the police that they doubt that story. A small kernel of doubt that soon takes full root and grows into the police pressuring her to admit that what happened to her never happened. She recanted the truth. This is how the article explained what happened next.
But her misdemeanor had made the news and made her an object of curiosity, or worse, scorn. It had cost her the newfound independence she was savoring after a life in foster homes. It had cost her sense of worth. Each ring of the phone seemed to announce another friendship lost. A friend from 10th grade called to ask, "How could you lie about something like that?" Marie, that's her middle name, Marie, didn't say anything. She just listened, then hung up. Even her foster parents now doubted her. She doubted herself, wondering if there was something in her that needed to be fixed.
Melissa and Shoba talk about the impact of disbelief when a rape survivor comes forward.
When people don't trust, you know, that's the worst thing that can happen to a person, that she's not trusted, she's not believed, and then it works in her mind over and over again. And then she'd be wondering, like, did it really happen to me? Or if it did, she gets very angry and she doesn't want to live with her parents or live with the people around her. And then she gets very disturbed, distressed, and so she becomes very dysfunctional. Her activities of daily living becomes very minimum. And so it's like she's crippled.
The culture of disbelief has many reaching impacts. Like within your own family, if you confess or you inform of the crime that has happened and then you have distress, you lose your support system or friends for that matter. But when you go to the authorities and you're treated with disbelief or people judge you as if you're a liar, which is a big issue, this can cause people to drop out, to give up. And then you don't see the value of reporting. And the overlying society, the impact on society is the rapists would get away with it. And the message that comes across is, I can do it again. But on the victim herself, she never got her access to justice. She never got her recourse to heal or to recover or closure. So it has very wide impact. Yeah.
This is Shannon, one of Marie's foster parents, and a woman close to her, explaining why she didn't believe Marie's story.
And I, you know, asked her, are you okay? And she, you know, said she was okay and that she was going to be staying, I think, with a friend that night. And when my husband got home, I told him what had happened, but I said, I don't know that it happened. There's something about how she said it that just made me question whether or not she'd actually been raped. It was a tone of her voice. There was just no emotion. It was like she was telling me that she'd made a sandwich.
This whole thing stems from a mistaken belief that there is an ideal way to respond to rape or trauma, an appropriate way to be a believable victim, which Armstrong and Miller firmly debunk.
Investigators, one guide advised, should not assume that a true victim will be hysterical rather than calm, able to show clear signs of physical injury and certain of every detail. Some victims confuse fine points or even recant. Nor should police get lost in stereotypes, believing, for example, that an adult victim will be more believable than an adolescent.
I asked Melissa and Shoba why the credibility of the victim of sexual assault always seems to be under investigation. And Melissa has a very sound analogy for it.
If we're talking about a woman reporting a crime, let's say I am walking in Bandar Utama carrying my handbag and someone snatched my handbag. Will people judge whether I've been drinking? Will people judge whether I have carried many expensive handbags in the past or something like that? But the issue of consent means that there is an inbuilt stereotype or prejudice against the person who's reporting rape. And for some reason, because of sexual offences, there's this mistaken misconception that people think women want to create the story or somehow implicate someone else. I'm not sure, for fun or for revenge or something like that. But this mistaken presumption actually does not match reality, because we have had many, many research that has shown that there's a very tiny amount of cases where people make up the stories. So credibility, because of the legal evidential system, keeps on putting it, saying it that it's one against one. But again, if it was snatch theft and there were no other witnesses, it's also one against one. So somehow, there's a very different unfair standard that's put on the rape victim.
Yeah. When it comes to sexual activity, it's different.
Yeah.
And so people have fun making fun of this kind of things. They don't take this seriously.
Coming along with the territory then is a fundamental prejudgment and bias that seems to be present when dealing with survivors of rape. Some might call it rape culture. We explore that next on Too Long Should Read, BFM 89.9.
Was me and a gun and a man on my back, and I sang holy, holy as he buttoned down his pants. You can laugh, it's kind of funny, the things you think in times like these. Like I haven't seen Barbados, so I must get out of this.
It's a case that's had painful consequences. A Rolling Stone article on the issue of campus rape that zeroed in on the story of Jackie. The University of Virginia student alleged that she'd been a victim of a gang rape at a fraternity party. Soon after, a rape on campus hit newsstands. The story began unraveling, leading the magazine to retract its report. Police say there's no evidence the attack ever took place. Rolling Stone's editors and the reporter of the story, Sabrina Rubin Erdely, have concluded their main fault was to be too accommodating of Jackie, not checking her assertions more carefully because they believe she was the victim of a terrible sexual assault.
This is Too Long Should Read, the show that focuses on interesting long reads around the internet. I'm Lee Chui Lin. The show today is Treading Dark Waters, dealing with issues of rape and why sometimes the voice of rape survivors don't get heard. Part of it is because of stories like what you just heard, encouraging the mistaken belief that women cry rape the way the boy cried wolf. Our article today is an unbelievable story of rape published on The Marshall Project and written by Ken Armstrong and T. Christian Miller. Here they explain the background of the fear of false rape accusations.
The fear of false rape accusations has a long history in the legal system. In the 1600s, England's Chief Justice Matthew Hale warned that rape is an accusation easily to be made and hard to be proved, and harder to be defended by the party accused. Judges in the US read the so-called Hale warning to juries until the 1980s. But most recent research suggests that false reporting is relatively rare. FBI figures show that police annually declare around 5% of rape cases unfounded or baseless. Social scientists examining police records in detail and using methodologically rigorous standards cite similar single-digit rates.
My guests for today are Melissa Ahir of the Women's Centre for Change and Shoba Ayar, counsellor and board member of Women's Aid Organisation, and they talk about how it is here in Malaysia.
For research that has been done overseas, it's usually around the 2% and 3%, which is not the majority. So for, say, 97% of other cases, there's no acknowledgement that rapes usually occur. Two, it's very hard to bring forward a report on rape. So why would someone want to go through the process, all the hardship, lose her time, accused of having bad character, just to make a story up?
Yeah, in Malaysia, one should understand a rape trial goes on for 5 years.
Yeah.
And I don't think any woman would want to lie and go through 5 years. And at the end of it, she doesn't get anything from it. It's not like a civil suit where she can sue the man and get compensation. She doesn't get anything except stigmatized by society. So why do you think a woman would want to lie?
Not only are survivors often thought to be lying outright, they're also relentlessly questioned over the tiniest of details, like Marie was. And any details that don't match up can be a pressure point. This is what happened when Marie mixed up when exactly she freed herself from the laces that tied her.
This didn't square with what Marie had previously told Mason. Before, she told the detective she had tried calling Jordan after cutting the laces. In this written statement, she described calling him while still tied up. Later that day, Mason talked to Ritgarn, his fellow detective, and said that, based on Marie's inconsistencies and based on what he had learned from Peggy and Jordan, he now believed Marie had made up the story.
Melissa responds to the notion that there can only be one consistent story told by a survivor throughout.
There is no normal reaction to trauma. Let's just say that the ground basis is rape would be traumatic, but your reaction to it may differ. For example, sometimes there's something called narrowing. When you are raped, some people may just focus on the perpetrator's hand. You cannot recall everything else. And then later on, you said you don't remember, but say 3 weeks after, you tell the police that, I remember he has a scar on the right shoulder. And then that can be said to be lying, when in fact, it is your natural reaction to trauma. These are survival methods. These are post-trauma syndrome, post-rape syndrome. So sometimes there's also delayed recall. You don't remember anything at all, and then you are judged as to have lied or to have made up the story afterwards, when that's how your brain works in reacting to the stress. And also sometimes you can feel like out-of-body experience. It's happening to someone else. I'm just observing. Yeah, but there's no normal reaction to rape. So someone who is watching it who has not been raped would say that, oh, a rape victim wouldn't react that way. Actually, you wouldn't know because you have never been raped.
Shobha shares her experience with a rape survivor whose memories were not just inconsistent, but lost for a time.
This afternoon, I was counselling somebody who was a rape victim. And it happened when she was 16. Today, she's 32. And at that time, she didn't remember many of the things. And she didn't want to lodge a police report or whatever it is because it was a close friend. But the repercussions has happened now. When she's doing something, she goes blank. And then she has to take time to recover. And her bosses somehow, she's very good at her work, but they have given some leeway to say that, you know, I just want this reporter in by tomorrow morning. I don't know what you do. So, but she delivers. But she has this lapses of time. And then she slowly took back steps, and then she asked her friend, actually, what happened on that day? She really didn't know. And then her friend told her what had happened. And then a few weeks ago, some incidents happened, and she remembered what he did. And today she vividly told me what he had done and things like that. So at that time, she was only 16, and she blanked it out and is in denial. But now it's slowly coming, and she says, this is what happened, and that picture has been consistent. Every time she talks to me for the past 2 weeks, it has been consistent. Mm.
But it was something that had been blocked out for a long time.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Thankfully, Melissa explains that there's space in our law for the way we think and remember and tell our truths.
Positively, at least, the law does give some room for these inconsistencies to be acknowledged as natural. For example, if it's called minor inconsistencies, it's still all right. There's actually, the late Sutta Azlan Shah actually said that when a person is totally 100% consistent, that's unnatural. Yeah, no one tells a story that way.
Yeah. Second, unless it's planned, you know, and written down.
Yeah, or coached or something like that.
You know, I mean, they would differ, like maybe right hand or, you know, upper arm, lower arm, the sequence. They could have said, like, he walked back or walked front or, you know, something like that. But not a very big significant change.
Yeah, and for us to address actual realities on the ground, if you remember, the late Augustine Paul has said, court system must look at accumulated knowledge of human behavior. So this is what we're trying to say. For the research that has been done into human behavior, there is no one single reaction to rape.
The show began with a reference to the Stanford rape case and Brock Turner. One of the main issues that has come up amidst all the noise is the culture of entitlement that Turner seems to exist in, a culture that seems permissive of rape, one quite eloquently written about in the newsroom in which a college student who had been raped explained why she was publicly outing her rapists online.
Do you want to live in a world where...
Do you want to hear the advice I get? I mean, this is real advice. In pamphlets. Say you have a boyfriend. Wear a wedding ring. I'm supposed to protect myself from a man by pretending I'm the property of another man. And of course, there's no shortage of good fashion advice.
Mary.
When you came in here, you wanted to go to a public place because you were scared I'd cry rape. I'm scared of getting rape. I'm scared all the time. All the time. So you know what my site does? It scares you.
This fear of ruining an alleged rapist's future, as we saw in the fictional world of The Newsroom and the real world of Brock Turner, comes up time and time again. Melissa addresses it.
It's actually rape culture, or you can even say patriarchy, because you're forgiving rape. Mm-hmm. Because let's say the same student has stolen a laptop. Would the same student be forgiven as compared to raping a fellow student? Sometimes there's a disproportionate treatment. Sometimes the impact of rape on the person is not looked at as a serious crime compared to something as like cheating in an exam, for example. Well, we can use the same arguments that, you know, you're ruining his future and all that. But usually there's no middle ground for that. But for rape, somehow, there's a forgiveness and permissive attitude towards it. But there's still quite a bit of victim blaming. Mm. For example, when they're teenagers, phrases that's been thrown about even by the enforcement is that maybe you seduced him. Mm. Why did you go out to the cinema with him? So there's still victim blaming. So this is where we're trying to say, even amongst teenagers, sometimes the girl who's usually the victim usually are blamed for even normal types of behaviour. Going to the, say, pasar malam right after rape is blamed as saying that, oh, you weren't raped because you went to a pasar malam. This actually happened in cases in court.
But we also can't quite dismiss that 2 to 5 to 10% of rape accusations that are false, that are life-ruining for the innocent people accused. How do we strike that balance of listening to and believing your victim? Shoba answers.
You'll have to listen first to believe, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you listen, you see to the body language, to the eyes, to what she's saying, and then you believe the story or put the story together. But I don't think so much as you must believe, as you listen for the facts and you make your story and then you do your investigation.
Yeah, and but still, because we didn't say blind belief, it's listen with an open mind. But however, it's still just our eyes observing the person. We are not human polygraphs. Don't start with disbelief. So if that wall is already up, that's the complete opposite to trying to pull a case together.
The survivor of the Stanford rape wrote and delivered a powerful address directly to her rapist, Brock Turner. And she, more than anyone else, exemplifies why it's crucial for rape survivors to have a voice, to be heard. CNN's Ashley Banfield reads an excerpt.
You are the cause. I am the effect. You have dragged me through this hell with you, dipped me back into that night again and again. You knocked down both our towers. I collapsed at the same time you did. Your damage was concrete, stripped of titles, degrees, enrollment. My damage was internal, unseen. I carry it with me. You took away my worth, my privacy, my energy, my time, my safety, my intimacy, my confidence, my own voice until today.
Shoba and Melissa have these words to offer on the subject of rape, and specifically for anyone who's been affected by it, directly or not.
She needs all the support that's warranted. And don't reject her at the first instance. Believe her story and give her help. Don't be so defensive and say, no, I don't believe you. Are you sure? You know, the very fact that you ask, are you sure, brings down her confidence. And she's not going to go on with her case or, you know, report it or get treatment in the hospital because you already doubted her. So, you know, and no one's going to just lie and say, I've been raped. In 100% of the cases, you can see evidence from the forensic doctor. Yes, there was penetration and it was recent. And so reserve all your comments for till the end. Don't do it at that time when she's very crucial and she needs your help.
For WCC Penang, we will keep repeating that you are not alone. If you're going through this, we cannot imagine what you're going through, but please do call us. We can journey together with you. So if I can also advise that services are free and confidential, and please give us a call. The numbers are 04-228-0342 and 04-398-3441. We have social workers who will journey with you from the time when you decide to make a report, if you need shelter, if you need to go to see the police, if you need to go to court, and even after, for referral, for therapy, for healing.
Yeah. I think it's similar to all the women's groups in Malaysia. In Kuala Lumpur, we have Women's Aid Organization and AWAM, and then you have in JB, right? You have in Penang, you have in Sabah and Sarawak. But if you can't find these groups for some reason, go to the general hospital of any general hospitals in Malaysia. All of them have a one-stop crisis center. And at the crisis center, the doctor will attend to you immediately. And there is a policeman on duty there. He would call somebody from the nearest police station to come over and take your report before the forensic doctor can take evidence.
That's it for our show this week. To read the article, check out An Unbelievable Story of Rape, written by Ken Armstrong and T. Christian Midler on the Marshall Project. It was also the subject of an excellent This American Life podcast. Look up episode 581, Anatomy of Doubt. And also for more homework, do read the Stanford Rape Survivor's Letter on BuzzFeed.com. It's beautiful and is essential reading. Now for our word of the week, when we've been talking about rape, the most important word to define is consent. And you could listen to me waffle on about it, but the Thames Valley Police did a much better and much more British job of it.
Still struggling with consent? Just imagine instead of initiating sex, you're making them a cup of tea. You say, hey, would you like a cup of tea? And they go, oh my God, I would love a cup of tea, thank you. Then you know they want a cup of tea. If you say, hey, would you like a cup of tea? And they're like, you know, I'm not really sure. Then you can make them a cup of tea, or not, but be aware that they might not drink it. And if they don't drink it, then, and this is the important bit, don't make them drink it. Just because you made it doesn't mean you're entitled to watch them drink it. And if they say, no thank you, then don't make them tea. At all. Just don't make them tea. Don't make them drink tea, don't get annoyed at them for not wanting tea. They just don't want tea, okay?
You can catch the rest of that on YouTube. Now for some bad news. I will be away for a month and I'm afraid Too Long Should Read will be going away with me. We'll resume regular programming after Raya, but in the next 4 weeks, this slot is going to be filled by something great, so stay tuned for that. And if you missed the show, catch up on the podcasts on bfm.my/too long. You've been listening to Too Long Should Read on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.